I came from a poor neighborhood. We called them poor neighborhoods in those days. They call them ghettos today. The only difference is I think there was much more respect as far as individuals having it for each other than there is today. My father was a barber, and he also worked for a toy company, Lionel Trains. Singing was something that I always wanted to do. My family, not knowing too much about it, just kind of thought that people that stayed out till strange hours of the night, that wasn't what was considered to be a real job.
Was there much music in the house in terms of anything they did, or you know, a lot of radio and records?
Yeah, my father was into classical music more than anything else. He liked the opera, and he liked singers like Caruso and Mario Lanza, and contemporary music was a very foreign thing as far as he was concerned.
Were you into that stuff much at all as a kid? You know?
Yes, I was. I was. I think that that was probably the start for me. Although I've had no formal musical education, I kind of educated myself.
That kind of, do you think maybe singing along with those records really helped stretch out your range and develop your vocal cords?
I think listening to stylized singing, people who were doing styles as opposed to school-taught kind of singing, people, there were a lot of, I was very heavily influenced by R&B music before it ever made the crossover, or blues, people like John Lee Hooker and B.B. King and Jimmy Witherspoon and Dinah Washington. I was also very much influenced by jazz, especially in big band form, people like Kenton.
How are you getting to hear like some of that blues stuff? Were there stations, you know, coming out of New York or whatever that were playing that?
No, they were strictly black radio, black-oriented radio stations who were playing that particular kind of music. They weren't even considered secondary markets in those days. I mean, they were really just about hanging in there.
Yeah, at what point, you know, did you start taking the music out of the house, you know, and singing in school or with friends?
Well, I did a lot of street corner singing, which was a tremendous help. I did some choir singing.
Was it school or church-oriented stuff? Or?
Yeah, church-oriented. Not that I'm terribly religious, but I do... I have my beliefs as far as religion is concerned. But I got a lot of harmonic value out of street corner singing and choir singing, which was kind of similar. I think a lot of early black music came from church music.
Were you always pretty much like in maybe the street corner singing groups, whatever, doing the lead, or did you find were you a background guy a lot?
I did a variation of everything. I like singing backgrounds as much as I do singing lead. In fact, all of the Four Season records, in most cases, I sang background and also sang lead on the records.
Was harmony something that you kind of just, you know, had an affinity for?
I just loved it. You know, I loved it. That's why I liked jazz in a big band form. I was very stimulated by groups like the Four Freshmen. And the Hilos, and the Modern Airs, and the Delta Rhythm Boys, and, you know, groups that did modern harmony.
Yeah, Hilos, and I think probably, they were probably really ahead of their time in the kind of jazz-oriented close harmony they were doing. It was a real challenge to pick apart those individual voices, wasn't it? I mean, dole them out to the...
Well, in the case of the Hilos, I think that they had, everybody in that band was a good singer. In the case of the Freshmen, I think the musicianship came before the singing, and the style was built around the fact that they weren't really great singers. It's just that when they sang together, they sounded like one. You know, the phrasing was identical, and the voice sounds were very similar.
Yeah, I don't think I agree with what you're saying. I don't think any one of those guys was an outstanding singer in his own right, the Freshmen. It's just they had that good blend and that way of phrasing.
The Beach Boys, I'm sure, were also terribly influenced by the Four Freshmen. You know, the modern type harmony.
Yeah, they really kind of chewed up the Freshmen and Barry, Chuck Berry, in one mouthful for their early days. And all came out together. At what point, you know, was it when you started to, you know, really do anything even somewhat professional?
I think I was about 15 when it began. I had a record contract at 15. I was recording at 16, and then from that point on, I was with various record companies, and I started doing background singing for producers, and I did a lot of demo work for publishers.
How did a kid from Jersey, you know, going over into the city, you know, at that age, especially break into doing that? I mean, what, you know, somebody, there must have been somebody, you know, that there's always
a lot of
one person that kind of opens the door for you.
Well, it was, I didn't read music, so I had to kind of push my way in the door a little bit and lie and tell people that I did read music. And how I overcame that was by, when there was a new song to be demoed, I would ask the writer to play it down a couple times so I could just get the feel. And I would learn it in that period of time, two or three times through, and I had the song pretty well down. I had nothing else to rely upon except for my memory and the fact that I wanted it so badly.
You think at that point, was there anything else in your mind that you thought you could have done if that didn't work out for you?
Well, I had done several things. I mean, I call them fill-in jobs. I was a hairdresser for a couple of years. I was a florist for a while. I worked construction. I did anything that I could do to survive.
Yeah, I think it would have been funny telling your construction buddies that the week before you were working as a florist.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the places that I worked, they all knew that that it was just a temporary situation and that I was more or less interested in being a performer than anything else. And I was very fortunate because I had a lot of the bosses that were over me in various jobs were good enough to allow me time off when I needed it to do particular things.
Yeah, both Bob Gaudio and Bob Crewe have different ideas as to when they think you probably discovered that falsetto of yours that is unlike anyone else's before or since. And when did you discover that you had that incredible upper range?
Well, I knew I had it all along. I mean, as I said, in listening to early R&B records, the falsetto thing wasn't anything that was brand new. I don't think there's anything musically that's brand new. I think we all take from each other bits and pieces and kind of formulate our own little identity.
Just your own, your own vocal cords doing maybe something that maybe the Drifters, you know, Clyde McFadden might have been doing. But it sounded different, though, with you doing it.
Well, I used it differently. I used it halfway legitimately so that it was stronger.
as opposed to a...
And in most cases, in the old days, they used to use it as just a background. We used it as a lead vocal. It worked out very well for us.
Was it something that you really had to work on and perfect to get the quality that you know that we hear on the early seasons records?
No, I think it was natural. I was doing it, and when I was doing background singing, and it really didn't make any difference whether I was singing lead or background. We were kind of innovating in those days and trying new things and trying to create a sound that would be ours and identifiable, and as soon as people heard it on the radio, they would know immediately that it was us. Whereas there are a lot of people who record today, and you can hear 10 different records, and there's such a similarity, it could almost be anybody. Identity is a very important thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, there was no mistaking a new Four Seasons record when it came out, and the guy would put it on the turntable. The kids probably didn't have to call up and ask who that was. They could just go straight to the record store.
Yeah, we did the kind of music we did in those days, too, was street music, is what I call it. You know, it wasn't, in the case of the Beach Boys, they did beach music. And we did street music, and there were songs about situations and that went on, and for people who were kind of roughing it up or coming from a poor environment and not looking forward to too much.
You were also drumming back then, too, for
yeah.
a while, weren't you?
For about 10 years, I was a drummer in the band until we decided that we should get a drummer and I should just sing lead.
Yeah, what are some of the difficulties, like, which Jerry does that a little bit with the Four Seasons, drumming and singing lead simultaneously. Is that a problem, rhythmic?
Well, it's not a problem. It wasn't a problem when I was doing it. It's just that when you start out playing and singing, the playing part of it, the drumming, becomes a crutch. It was a little difficult to stand in front of a mic without anything in my hands. That was probably the hardest part, and it took about a year or so to get used to.
Were you, like when you're doing the background sessions and things in New York and the demos and stuff, were you always pretty much in a group type situation, or were you doing a lot of stuff totally on your own?
Well, I did a lot of solo things. As you know, I sing in a regular voice besides a falsetto voice, so I did a variation of many, many things. I did everything from R&B to what was considered to be pop in those days. I mean, pop.
Right. Yeah, Teresa Brewer was once called pop. It, were there any background sessions that you did that are memorable, that went on to become hits at all? Who were some of the backup for?
There were some. I did backgrounds on records with Danny and the Juniors and Freddie Cannon and the Rays, who did Silhouettes, and Billy and Lily, and you know, I did a lot of different things, variation of whatever I could do. You know, it meant making some money and kind of keeping my foot in the door. So I did anything they wanted me to do.
It was probably a good learning experience in terms of studio work too.
Well, I had a lot of studio experience, so that was really something that was on my side.
Did you meet Bob Crewe or Bob Gaudio first back then?
I met Bob Crewe first, actually. Bob Crewe and I had gotten to know each other because when I was trying for a solo career in very, very early days before very much was happening, Bob Crewe was also working on a solo career as a singer. And we had met in various places around the country where he was promoting a record that he had out, and I may have had a record out and I was promoting. Gaudio I met in Pittsburgh. We were doing a television show. We exchanged telephone numbers. We got together, and we've been together ever since.
Was he still in the Royal Teens at that time?
Yes, that was just about ending in that period of time. He joined us.
Was the group in the incarnation of the Four Lovers at that point?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, had you been familiar with his work at all, or
Well, I was familiar with his work, but the thing I was most impressed with were some of the new things that I'd heard that he was writing. They were probably more stimulating to me than some of the things he had done in the past. But I knew he was very talented. We got along very well together, and so we decided to hook up.
Tell me about that. As I told Bob the other day, this to me is I think my favorite story in the music business, and I think the nicest one. You guys have based a career that spanned over 20 years on the basis of a handshake.
Yeah. We have a great rapport, Bob and I. We're a partnership. The whole thing is on a handshake. Either one of us can dissolve it at any time we want. Neither Bob or I have found any reason why we should dissolve our partnership. We don't weigh it as a, you know, and according to who's doing more than the other, because everything kind of evens itself out.
Did you two really realize early on that between the two of you, you had pretty much, you know, all the bases covered in terms of...
I think that's probably one of the reasons that we decided on such a partnership. Bob is a very open-minded individual. If you really knew him well, you would understand that. And there have been periods of time where we were recording, and he and crew may have run dry for a while, and as all writers do. And Bob is open-minded enough to look outside for material, and we have in several cases.
Were there ever times when business people you might hook up with at a label or something that, you know, would find out on what your business relationship was based, that handshake, and just be so amazed by that, they go, well, this is crazy, you guys, you got to get this down on paper.
Well, nobody really believes it to this day. It's really rare. It very rarely ever happens in this business.
Nowadays, most contracts aren't good if they're disputed. Right. Handshake.
Well, contracts are only as good as the paper they're written on anyway.
Yeah,
there are a number of ways to get out of a contract. Someday I'd like to write a book on contracts and managers and attorneys and accountants and so forth and so on. That might be helpful to anybody who is thinking about getting involved in the record business or in show business in any sense.
It would probably save a lot of anguish and heartache for a lot of kids that don't really.
Well, I think there are too many people out there who take advantage of the ignorance of a performer as far as the business part of it is concerned. It's rather difficult being a good businessman and being creative. I know my education as far as understanding the business end of what I do has been a very costly one.
At what point did, after you met Bob and hooked up with him, did he become a member of the Four Lovers right away? Did you just pull him into the group? Or?
Yes, he became a member right away.
Was he writing a lot then at that
point? He was, and we were going in and demoing a lot of the things he was writing, and that's how we made our deal with Bob Crew. Actually, through some masters that we had made.
In what capacity at that point? Because he was, you know, although Bob Gaudio also certainly had a big part in the production in those early days, and even more so as time went on, how did Crew's, you know, role as producer?
Well, Crew had a credibility to start off with. Crew has been making hit records from the early 50s. I mean, he was involved in a lot of the early rock records, all the Freddie Cannon records and the Danny and the Juniors and the Rays and Billy and Lily and what have you. So he had early credibility. So it was much easier that way. And in those days, most record companies had an A&R staff, and there were very, very few independent producers.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you before we get a little too far past that, because the trivialists out there and the Four Seasons fans would love to know this. Are you actually singing on, like, Silhouettes?
Yes.
How about at the Hop? I know you mentioned Danny.
I don't really remember all the things we did at that time. I mean, we were really... It's like asking a session musician which hits he's been on, and it's really when you're halfway between working on your own career and just doing these things as dates and just hearing them in their preliminary stages and not really hearing finished product. It gets kind of hard to remember, and we're talking past 20 years already.
Yeah. And a lot of times, I'm sure there's so many instances where a session musician has played on something by the time the final thing comes out, and they may...
They don't even recognize it, right.
Yeah. And did you then, you know, because I know in terms of the Four Seasons Masters and things like that, you and the two Bobs have like a three-way deal going. Did you cement that relationship back then? Was it a...
Shortly after we had some success, it was cemented. It was something that we'd always been interested in doing, always interested in. And first of all, when you have in-house situation as we did, as far as writers were concerned and singers and what have you, we felt it was important to build a publishing and production situation.
You guys were really ahead of your time in terms of some of the business decisions you made back then, because there are things that you guys did back then that still are not commonplace by any means today in terms of retaining, you know, your masters and you know, that in particular.
Well, that's true. It's something that you know, it's thinking beyond a hit record. You know, that's why a lot of kids who've had big successes today are really in a situation of being cash poor.
Yeah,
or asset poor, you know, and those are things you should be thinking about. My ultimate dream was always to build a record company and have everything in-house.
Is that a dream that's going to be realized?
We'll see. The future is too far ahead to really predict that. We're in the process of building a studio, so we'll be developing a lot of people, writers and performers and what have you.
I guess in the various incarnations of the group, or at least under the different guises of the Ford Lovers, and I guess Frankie Valli and the Romans was one, right? And you guys did a lot of label jumping. You'd cut a side or two for, I guess, Epic and RCA and Gone Records.
Well, in those days, that's what it was. I mean, you didn't get more than a chance or two. Today, it's a lot different. A record company will sign an artist and make a long-term deal. Long-term deals were far and few between when I started out.
You seem to go from all those other records, which were obscure even by those, you know, by those day standards, to suddenly, you know, having, you know, a number one record that was if Sherry wasn't the biggest record of that year, you're the next single you guys put out.
Well, we had three in a row, and it was really a wonderful experience. I mean, for somebody to have. Each record knocked the other one out of number one. That was really nice.
Did you know that? Did you know when you cut Sherry, when you came out of the studio? I think it's Bob told me the other day. That was like a demo session, literally, that where you cut like five things,
right?
All of which became hit singles.
We cut a variation of things and tried different sounds on different things. But we'd worked on them for about 3 or 4 weeks before we went in to cut them, so we knew basically what we were coming up with. It's like now we're working a lot like we used to. You know, we're running everything down first and rehearsing it in a rehearsal studio, as opposed to going into a studio and coming up with ideas for $200 an hour.
Yeah, $20 in a rehearsal room.
Right.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Did Bob Gaudio and Bob Crewe, you know, either individually or collectively, when they were writing those early records, did they specifically write them for your falsetto, knowing that that was probably a hit sound?
Yes, they were written with that in mind. Once we had developed the sound that we wanted to use, and we felt we had a chance of having success with it, we stayed in that pattern, even though the songs were changing and we were doing a variation of material. We tried not to stay in the same pattern for too long a period of time. The thing was to keep the sound of the group, but change the kind of song we did. I mean, from Sherry to Big Girls Don't Cry to Walk Like a Man, there are variations. And from there to Dawn, to Ragdoll, to Ronnie, to Save It For Me, to I've Got You Under My Skin, you know, there were lots of different changes and different things that we did, but still maintaining the same sound of the group, the vocal sound.
Yeah, the tracks became more contemporary and advanced as
right.
It progressed. Did you know, coming out of that initial like demo session that produced Sherry and Big Girls Don't Cry, did you guys really have a feeling that I think, you know, these are going to be the ones that do it?
Well, you never really know that. The best you can do is go in and record things that you believe in. And sometimes, even if they don't happen, you have to stay with what you believe in for a while until you can get your point across or until you have success with it. But you must never be afraid of change.
How did you guys hook up with VJ, which was a Chicago-based label? And was...
Well, that was because we, in a VJ situation, we got involved in it, and part of the deal was getting the masters back. And that's why we hooked up with VJ as opposed to one of the major companies. Everybody thought the Four Seasons were a black group to start off with, and VJ was a black company. So we had a number of R&B hits in a period of time where white artists just didn't even get played on R&B radio. We've had a good rapport R&B-wise, and probably because a lot of what we were doing was believable in
all
the R&B
records,
markets.
All those records are real big in the R&B chart. In fact, I mean, where maybe one of your singles maybe only got up to two or three, you know, a few years down the line, they were still number one on the R&B charts. They seem to, they probably recognize some of your roots, you know.
Oh, sure. Well, I grew up in a mixed neighborhood, and as I said, I was tremendously influenced by black music right from the beginning. You know, it was, I related to it because of what it said and what it was doing. It was in a period of time where, a suppressed period in one's life where there weren't too many opportunities waiting for you.
Yeah, you sort of, I think this week, as you mentioned earlier, with Chuck Berry and the Beach, and the freshman for the Beach Boys, you kind of chewed up that whole soul thing yet in the context of what, like, the high lows are doing. Which really probably accounts for the mass appeal that you guys had. You know, how long after, like, say, Sherry, you know, took off, and then the follow-ups, which did equally well, if not better, did you guys get the act together and, you know, go out on the road?
Oh, we went out on the road. First of all, we were a working group to start off with. I mean, we worked in a lot of the local lounges and saloons and around the country. We stayed as close to New York as we possibly could for a number of reasons. First of all, the record business sort of centralized around New York City and the publishing business, and there was a lot more going on in New York in those days, and plenty of clubs, the Copacabana.
You know, I guess, you know, back in those days, sorry. Staring that in the eye, and likewise. I guess back in those days, as soon as, you know, a record starts to break, you know, boom, you must have been on Bandstand and all the, you know, the pop-oriented things.
Yeah, there were many more vehicles in those days. The money wasn't so terrific, but you knew you were on your way. We did lots of tours we did bus tours with 10 or 12 acts, and, you know, people like Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke would go out on the road and take a whole show with them. Maybe there'd be seven or eight or nine acts in the show. We'd go play the country with it.
Those bus trips must have been a bit grueling, but the camaraderie that you probably had going to those performances.
Well, I miss that a great deal. You know, I think that was a part of the business that I loved more than anything. You know, the opportunity of getting to know and getting to meet and really know the individual performers. And everybody worked closer than they do today, more like a team.
You probably got to meet a lot of your heroes and stuff, too, starting in those early days.
Oh, sure I did.
Success,
yeah, I did. I got to, in 1963, I worked the Apollo Theater with Jerry Butler and Ike and Tina Turner and Godfrey Cambridge. Which was a sensational experience for me. And the acceptance was sensational. So, and I worked all the tours. I worked mixed tours, and I worked a lot of tours where we were the only white act on the tour.
And back in those days, especially when you get down the south, too, that could probably be a little bit touchy.
Well, it was hairy at times. There were lots of problems. That's when the integration problems were really at their peak. In the days of Ole Miss.
Yeah, I can imagine that a lot of those shows you just want to get on the bus real fast once you're done.
It was good, though, because I got an insight and a better understanding all the way around as far as people were concerned and some of the social problems that we had in this country. There was a lot of it I didn't quite understand, you know, especially coming from a mixed neighborhood where we were all kind of close to start off with, so I couldn't quite understand what was happening.
Before we get a little bit past that, I remember you telling me a couple of years ago that You know, how you went from Frank Castelluccio to Frankie Valli, you know, and a person that helped you out a little bit back then, took your name from.
Well, it was a lady whose name was, she was a country singer, and she'd heard me singing in a club in New Jersey, and extended her help to me and introduced me to some people in New York, and she introduced me as her brother, and that's how I got my foot in the door, actually. Her name was Jean Valli, so the guy that became my first manager was a music publisher whose name was Paul Capp, the brother of the famous Dave Capp, who had his own record company and also at one time was head of RCA Victor. So he actually changed my name to Valli. And everyone in the business got to know me as Frankie Valli. And so the name kind of stuck. If I had it to do all over again, I'd probably use my own name.
Are you legally Frank Capp?
Yes. No, I'm legally Frankie Valli. It's really Francesco.
Francesco
Castelluccio.
Do any of your old friends, say back in Jersey, whatever, if you ever cross paths with somebody like that, they still refer to you? Sure, your mom.
Well, they refer to me as Frankie, so
yeah.
We don't really. Nobody really says anything about the last name, and from those times, there were a lot of singers who had to change their last name for various reasons.
Yeah, I still don't
understand.
Don Ciccone today told me what Joe Long's real name was.
Yeah,
I knew it had to be some good Italian name. And did you guys ever in those early days when, I mean, you were cranking out singles as soon as one's peaked, you know, the next one was out. I mean, did you ever just stop and analyze what you've been doing right and to do it again and be able to do it again?
Why try to analyze something that's working? I mean, you know, this is the kind of a business that you can run a streak, and I think as long as you keep changing and make records that people like to hear, you'll have hit records. I don't think it matters one bit how long you've been around. There have been many artists who have proved that over and over again. You just make records that are in the groove and people will go out and buy them. I think we're in a time where age is not really an important factor anymore.
Yeah, you've got you've been on the charts at times probably when there was someone, you know, half your age, you know, with a hit.
Absolutely.
It really doesn't matter as long as the record's good.
If the record's in the groove, I mean, that's more important than anything.
You know, who were some of the people, like, say, prior to the Beatles, which I want to ask you about in a minute, that were kind of contemporaries that were sort of pushing you guys creatively, you know, at the same time, you know, people you really respected?
There were a lot of people we respected, but we were trying to develop our own thing, so we really weren't following any pattern. Even when the Beatles did happen, we still continued to do the Four Seasons. I mean, there was no reason in the world why we should all of a sudden want to take a direction of being the Beatles. They'd already established that. And I wouldn't find anything original in that. There were a lot of groups who began to follow that pattern and very quickly went by the wayside.
Bob told me that you guys were on a tour of England, and it was before the Beatles had really broken in the States yet. And you picked up on them sort of early on.
Yeah, I remember we were in Europe and I'd taken some time off and went to I went to Rome for a few days, and the Beatles were appearing in the city, and I stopped by the hotel and called up, and we went upstairs and spent a good part of the day together, and found that they were fans. And you know, you keep finding out as you go on that there are many, many people who have had great, great success who have been fans of the Four Seasons over the years.
Did you guys sing anything while you spent some time together?
No, we just talked music and got to know each other a little bit.
In fact, Bob mentioned to me the other day also that, and this may have been a first, he said, you guys had thought about covering, maybe Please Please Me, which was in the trend at the time.
Yeah, right. We heard a lot of Beatle music when we were in Europe and loved it. Not too much was happening with it at the time, but I really felt that it was good and had good possibilities, and we were thinking about doing some of it, because some of it fit in what we were doing at the time.
In fact, it sounds very plausible that you and what Bob had to say to the people at VJ and talking about, you know, this group may have had something to do with the Beatles hooking up with VJ.
Possibly. There was a period of time where VJ had the Beatles, Jerry Butler, Betty Everett, Gladys Knight, John Lee Hooker, Dee Clark, Gene Chandler, the Four Seasons. They were about to become a major record company, and they had some financial problems. I don't know where the trouble started, but the company very quickly went under.
It's hard to believe that with that kind of roster they could fail.
I know, including the fact that they had Jimmy Clanton at the time and were having a success with him.
Yeah. How did you guys feel when VJ itself? I mean, there were all sorts of things saying, "Well, the Beatles are coming along," and the Beatles really did actually put a lot of acts out of business in terms of changing things around.
They only put acts out of business who tried to follow the pattern of what they were doing. There were a lot of acts that still stayed alive. All the Motown acts stayed alive. The Beach Boys stayed alive. The Four Seasons stayed alive. You can't really stay alive too long following or trying to be someone else. I mean, there's nothing better than the original.
Really, the Four Seasons and the Beach Boys were probably the only two American groups that had major success, though, before the Beatles, that continued, you know, maintained throughout the Beatlemania thing and beyond that, and certainly years beyond it.
Well, we must remember that the population of the world warrants more than one particular artist. I mean, that's why Baskin-Robbins makes 36 flavors, because not, or 31, whatever it is. Because various people have different tastes, you know, so there's something for everyone.
Was it ever at all threatening? I mean, when you saw what was happening and how suddenly every label, you know, in the business was signing guys with their hair cut like this and with you know, some sort of English accent, and that you thought maybe there's going to be such an onslaught of this that what we're doing is not going to be what the public wants tomorrow.
The only way you would know that is by doing what you're doing and finding out by putting records out and seeing if they were successful. You know, there's no sense in getting frightened. It's like one football team being frightened because the other one has a quarterback that everybody likes, or they have a pass receiver who's sensational. Each team has something different to offer.
VJ, more than anybody, tried to get a lot of mileage out of creating a sort of Four Seasons versus the Beatles kind of thing with several albums that they put out with you guys, each one side a piece. And the only thing they didn't do practically was take pictures of you with gloves on facing each other.
Yeah. That was something we had no control over. Record companies will do things like that. I mean, you know, they're in business to make money, and however they do it is they're going to do it.
Were you at all dismayed about, you know, those practices at the time?
Well, I couldn't have been because, as I said, we had no control over that. I mean, record companies could couple records with any other artist they wanted to. They were in complete control as far as that was concerned. Mm-hmm. All I really worried about is what I was doing. I wasn't so concerned about what anyone else was doing. And we kind of ran our whole operation that way.
Early on, I asked Bob a little bit about this, and he vaguely remembered it. The Beach Boys and the Four Seasons seemed to, on cuts that each one of you did, took a friendly shot at each other one time. The Beach Boys had a song called Surfer's Rule, where at the end of the song, you know, Brian ripped off one of your riffs. And was singing Four Seasons, You Better Believe It. And then you guys, shortly thereafter, had a B-side that was called No Surfing Today. Was that a friendly little thing you had to
do? First of all, I'm a great admirer of the Beach Boys. probably one of their biggest fans. Something that I've been trying to do for the past 5 years is hook up a situation where we could do a concert tour together. I have specific ideas on it, you know, call the tour East Meets West or West Meets East, and doing a show in certain kind of segments where we did it on an elevating stage, that 15-minute segments each. I haven't been able to hook it up. I've been trying for a long time, but I think it would. I think something like that would really be historical as far as rock and roll music is concerned.
Did you guys ever, back in those days when, I mean, concerts back in the mid-60s, early 60s, you know, a kid could pay, you know, $3 to see a show, and he'd see 10 of, you know, the biggest, you know, acts in the record business at the time. You know, they each did come out and do a couple of songs. Did you guys ever?
Well, acts are more or less interested today in getting all the money they possibly can. I don't think it's fair to the public. And I'll probably get a lot of flack for saying that, but that's my true feeling. I think that the act is obligated to give the public everything they can. People pay good, hard money to go and see a concert. They shouldn't be cheated. They shouldn't be taken for granted. You're only a star as long as you have an audience, so they can take that star away from you anytime they like. So you have to learn to appreciate it and appreciate your audiences and not take them for granted.
Yeah, once VJ, I guess that was about 65 when VJ kind of bit the dust, and you guys moved over to Philips and with catalog in tow, which probably at that time you really couldn't have been aware of just how valuable that was. I mean, only time.
Well, I knew that if we continued to have success, that it would be incredibly valuable one day. It was just a matter of time and waiting it out and seeing if it was that valuable or not.
Your whole career with Philips, that even Philips, you know, eventually sort of disappeared. You guys, considering, we were really laughing a lot the other day about this, Bob and I talking about all the labels that you guys recorded for in the early days and throughout. And you made a lot of money for them, but they all managed to go under.
I know. It was... Well, Philips was eventually, it was Mercury Records, and it was bought up by Consolidated Electronics, which is a major company, probably one of the largest companies in the world. They make all the electric light and telephone equipment for Europe. Plus, they're in the electronic business, and they're in the research business. And that company has been sold a couple times. It's a German-owned company now.
A lot of times a label change can be disastrous for a group, but you guys actually even overlapped with Hit Records. You know, that VJ finished up putting some stuff out, and you'd already started.
We had lots of hits after we left VJ. We had Alone and Stay, and we had a lot of things.
Yeah,
we did. We had a hit with Ain't That a Shame on VJ. So there were several other things that became hits. We had a couple of double-sided hits. Candy Girl and Marlena were both hits at the same time. Then when we went to Philips, we recorded The Four Seasons, Frankie Valli, and The Wonder Who all at the same time. We had three things in the top 20 or 30.
What went into, you know, your deciding that you wanted to do a solo thing, you know, apart and distinct from the group yet remaining?
Well, I always wanted to do a solo thing, and I thought the things that I wanted to do, the solo things I wanted to do, were not in character as to what we were doing with the group, so there was really no clash. And, you know, there were a lot of pros and cons about competing with each other, and I just didn't feel it was really competing. What was the difference if Frankie Valli had a record out competing against the Four Seasons, which I didn't feel was a competition? We had a whole industry out there to compete against. So why sit and worry about what you're competing against? It was an in-house situation, so everything went to the same place, so it didn't really matter.
It's doing the solo stuff, too. You got to get a little bit away from at least your sound with the Four Seasons, where you didn't use the falsetto, really, and... at least nowhere near to the extent.
And most of the hits I had as a solo artist were classic kind of hits of songs that probably will get incredible coverage over the years.
I can't take my eyes off you.
Or My Eyes Adored You, or Swearing to God. I mean, we're all
alone. Yeah. Have been covered by just innumerable.
Right. We had the first record on Native New Yorker.
Right. It sounds like, and you were getting a lot of airplay in different regions and stuff when Odyssey came out and got that out. It sounds like everyone involved with Can't Take My Eyes Off You really didn't hit him at first. Bob said, you know, that record was worked a long time, and even he and crew, you know, didn't.
So was My Eyes Adored You. My Eyes Adored You was a chart record for about 26 weeks. And in the beginning, in the early part of its success, according to the trades, it lost its bullet three or four different times, and then would revitalize itself and come back again a couple weeks later, and it didn't have that initial impact around the entire country. It was the kind of a record you had to hear more than one time. That's why it's terribly unfair to listen to a record in one listen and say that's either good or bad. I mean, it takes more than that.
It's interesting how those records, like My Eyes Adored You and Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, that are such standards that can be recorded and will be forever, probably would have that kind of sleeper type thing. You know.
Well, ballads are usually slow coming on. Once you have a hit with a ballad, though, it lasts forever. It's not like an up-tempo song.
Can't Take My Eyes Off You was originally scheduled to be a B-side, I think, wasn't it? My Mother's Eyes.
Yeah, the A-side. Right.
And, how'd the Wonder Who thing come about? Because it almost has a jokey type, you know.
It was kind of a camp idea, and we approached it that way. I was in the studio, we were doing a rundown on it, and just kind of kidding around. And they said, hey, let's do it that way.
Were you guys actually going to cut it as a Four Seasons record? Or?
We were cutting it as a Four Seasons record for a part of an album that we were putting together. We were constructing an album of songs written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David and Bob Dylan. One side the Bacharach David and the other side Dylan.
Why was it put out as the Wonder Who? I mean, why wasn't that a Four Seasons record?
Because we felt it was different enough to warrant a different name.
Was there maybe a little bit of an ego thing there, going to see, well, let's see, we're having all these hit records, but is it because they're Four Seasons records, and will a record by us, the same individuals?
Well, the idea Wonder Who came out of the fact that I played it for a small radio station that was, we were working at the Steel Pier in Atlantic City, and the man from the record company, the radio station came down and to see the show, and he did an interview, and I played him some of the new things, and he loved it, and he taped Don't Think Twice, and he went and he played it on the radio and said, guess who this is? And that's what gave the whole idea of the Wonder Who.
Right, I guess right around that time, you guys sort of had a hit pulled out from under you before you got to put it out, Silence is Golden.
Yes, right.
How did that come about?
We've had a number of times where that's happened. It's also happened with The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine.
Yeah, 6 months after you had it out,
right.
Walker Brothers. But the tremolos, virtually note for note, lifted your whole arrangement.
So did the Walker Brothers with The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine.
Yeah.
But that makes you feel good in a sense, because you know you were in the right direction. It's the same thing with the We're All Alone record. About 3 months after we had recorded it and put it out, along came Rita Coolidge and had a smash with it.
Yours was still a top 40
right.
record, though. Yeah. That really says a lot for the song itself when you can get and even Boz Scaggs' version of it did all right.
He happens to be an incredible artist. But there are a lot of incredible artists right now. I mean, Billy Joel is one of my favorite. One of my all-time favorites are Ashford and Simpson. I love anything Barry White does.
That's interesting. You know, have you ever heard Barry White's comment about you? I've seen it printed 1,000 times over. I think the exact line was, Frankie Valli is the greatest white singer ever.
Oh, that's nice.
In fact, I will be seeing Barry on Thursday.
Well, I wish you would give him my regards. And when we finish this interview, I'll give you a phone number. Tell him to give me a call.
I'll do
like to see him.
when things did start to slow down a little bit, and the top 40 records did stop for a while, and you guys did a project, the Imitation, Genuine Imitation Live Gazette, which was really the Four Seasons' first concept album, at least thematically and lyrically and everything. It was really an adventurous project.
We wanted to make a comment. That's what happened. There was so much protest music going on at that time, and so many things happening in the world, and we did it in the form of a newspaper, which later on became a success by everybody in the business. All of a sudden, Jethro Tull came along with an album cover that looked like a newspaper, and several other people did the same thing. I enjoyed doing that project. It was one of my favorite projects, and it was a step in another direction. Unfortunately, the record company thought it was really off the wall and didn't really give it the concentration that we thought it deserved.
It really was like a whole new thing for you guys, and I think maybe the record company just sort of sat on that a little bit.
They just weren't sure, you know, and there were some really heavy songs in there.
It's real popular with the people that know it.
Yeah.
Its chief problem was it just didn't get heard.
We were writing about all of the social problems in those days, and we were singing about those things. We had a song in the album called Saturday's Father, which has become a very popular subject in these times of marriages breaking up and the father who comes to pick up the children on Saturday and the trauma that goes down and the effect it has on people's lives.
What kind of effect did it have on you when the singles, you know, did stop happening and things, the concert thing continued to be good, but the records were not hitting the way that they had. I know Bob went into a very serious case of depression, he said.
Well, we had a lot of problems in those days. One of them was the fact that after the Genuine Imitation Life album, We were in litigation with a record company, so we weren't really allowed to record in that period of time. We were really annoyed with the fact that the record company, it was the first project that we had taken on where we wanted to make a statement. And they just didn't believe in us enough to really go out and work it, because I think it was probably one of the classic pieces of work that we've ever done.
And that's got to be especially mystifying and anger-inducing. Sounds lame, but when your track record had been so good, and you'd made them a lot of money, and you sort of had gotten to the point where you deserved to be able to do something and get the kind of support.
Well, those kind of things happen. You know, in many cases, whether it be from record companies or radio or whatever, you kind of get typed and people expect to hear a particular kind of record from an artist. I don't think that has to be that way. You know, there are a lot of really talented people out there. I mean, look how long it took for Ashford and Simpson to finally really break through. One of the best singing teams this business will ever know about. I mean, I think Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson are two of the most talented people and two people that I love incredibly.
And they're still, they finally did, and they sell a lot of records now, but you know, they're still looking for that first top 40 record of their own singing. It's at least nowadays with the way the market is, a whole artist's, you know, career isn't necessarily based on that top 40.
Well, it shouldn't have to be based on that. I mean, it's terrific to have a hit record. And it's terrific to have a record company that really believes in what you're doing and is going to work on everything you do. It takes a great deal of work. You have to realize that competition out there, as far as record companies are concerned, some of the smaller record companies don't have the kind of funding that a major has and can't do a $250,000 or $500,000 campaign on the record, or can't afford to eat a $500,000 records. You know, with all of this that's been going on with the record business, there have been a lot of readjustments in record companies with people, and the artist rosters are getting smaller. And they're realizing that you can't spend that kind of money on every artist.
You had a somewhat brief, you know, affiliation with Motown that didn't really work out, and that deal you ended up walking away with another master, or some masters that included My Eyes Adore.
Right.
How hard was it at that point to, because it had been a long time since you'd had a top 40 record, even though you continued touring successfully. How hard was it to get through program directors' heads across this country that here was new, you know, vital, you know, material that had...
Well, My Eyes Adore You was probably turned down by every record company in the business, except for Larry Utah, which doesn't mean that, you know, that record companies were wrong. That's what their feeling was, and that was okay. I never really wanted to leave Motown. I liked Motown, and some of the people there were really... I had gotten very close to. I've gotten very close to Suzanne DePass, who was an executive in a creative sense. And Berry Gordy is one of my favorite people. Most people know Berry Gordy from Motown, but Berry Gordy was a successful writer long before he was a record company, a record producer. He wrote a lot of the early Jackie Wilson hits.
He's finally gotten back around and doing some more writing.
Yes, he did. Well, you know, the time we went with Motown, he'd given me a personal commitment of his time. And unfortunately for me, unfortunately for him, he got involved in a movie called Lady Sings the Blues. And it was rather difficult splitting his time, and that's where the unhappiness came. But he was a gentleman in every sense of the word when it came time to getting out of the situation. And not too long ago, I almost made a deal with him again. And I would have no reservation about making a deal with him in the future. I think he's an incredible talent. I think he's a brilliant guy. And more important than anything, I like him.
Right off the bat, Frankie Valli as a solo entity and Frankie Valli with the Four Seasons suddenly, simultaneously, you know, it seems like exploded back, you know, on the charts with top 40 records and probably a lot bigger concert, you know, attractions and things too that always come along with hit records. Was that a thing that you and Bob Gaudio sort of in your scheme of things had planned?
We did. It was something we always had in the back of our mind. There was no sense in stopping it. I think the most fun I'm having is right now.
Yeah, what's happening right now? You've got the Four Seasons.
Well, I have Jerry.
For a few years.
Yeah, I have Jerry Pulci back with me, who was the lead singer on December '63, along with myself and Don Ciccone, who was also back. We're working with a lot of the old team. Gaudio was involved. From a writing point of view, so am I. Charlie Colello, who was the arranger on a lot of our earlier things, is now involved and is putting these things together with myself and Gaudio. Jerry Corbetta, who comes from a group called Sugarloaf, who had a great success with that particular group, is now with me. It's an incredible band, it really is, and it's we're working self-contained. We're not carrying any horns or strings or anything, and I'm really having a ball. We just did a month in England and Scotland. Every date was successful.
Why weren't there any Four Seasons for about 2.5-3 years?
We decided to split up, and then we were getting a lot of mail from people around the country as to why we'd never recorded a live album, and it kind of stimulated us and gave us an excuse to get back together, and that's one of the things we're working on right now, putting together the live album. And in the live album we'll probably do 3 or 4 potential singles of brand new material.
It'll have to be a double album, won't it?
I'm not sure whether it's going to be a double album or not. With the economy, it just may be the wrong time to do a double album.
In terms of future things, are the Four Seasons recording with you included in
yes.
with the Curb deal?
Yes. We will be recording together as Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons for Warner Curb. And I'll continue my solo recording with MCA.
Is it nice to have that group? I mean, to have that camaraderie and be in that group situation again where the guys are...
I'm loving it. I mean, I am really bathing in it. It is sensational. I'm having so much fun. It's great.
Are there any particular songs, you know, over the years that evoke, that maybe are, you know, particular favorites or that evoke, you know, something in particular?
I think everything I recorded at the time was a favorite of mine. Or I wouldn't have recorded it. An amazing experience for me also was working with Barry Gibb, who I'd been a fan of for a very long time. And again, I'd also found that he was a big fan of the Four Seasons. We'd, about 4 or 5 years previous to doing Grease together, we'd done a concert here in L.A. with Sly and the Family Stone, and Stevie Wonder and the Eagles, and the Bee Gees, and the Four Seasons, and you know, just a whole bunch of people.
I wish I'd seen that show.
Yeah, it was really a great show.
Was it for some event, or was it just...
It was, I forget exactly what it was for, but the show was also being aired live while we were doing it.
Yeah, exactly how were you approached? Because I know, you know, Barry's affiliation with Robert Stigwood and everything led to his involvement with the project. How was it that you got involved with that?
Well, when we did that concert together, we were talking about possibly doing some things together. And when this project came up, Barry remembered all of our conversations, and I'd seen him previous to that. He was in L.A. for something. I think they were doing the Sgt. Pepper movie. And he told me he was working on a particular project that he thought was right for me, and he sent me the song, and it was sensational. I loved it right away.
How did you like The Spinners, working my way back to you?
I loved it. They're another favorite group of mine. The Spinners, the Four Tops, the Diana Ross, Rod Stewart, Elton John, and, you know, there are a number of people who are really super favorites of mine, including Blondie. I love everything she's doing. A lot of it is reminiscent of the early days of rock and roll. You know, it's back to the basics again.
I'll leave that alone. If you had to say what you know, the Four Seasons contribution, like, you know, to pop music has been over the years, or in fact what importance Four Seasons have had, you know, do you have, you know, some way you could sum that up?
You could probably say that easier than I could, or quicker than I could. I never looked at it for anything more than I was doing something that I really loved to do. Hoping that the people who bought records would like what we're doing. Doing it with as much honesty as I knew about. I wasn't shucking and jiving. And I was really loving what I was doing. And still am.
Yeah. Geez, you know, I having talked to you about this before, I guess when we did our thing, 1840, a couple of years ago, I talked about it, and I really should ask you a little bit about this, because this is something that just was a major thing in your life. I don't want to leave this out. You know, the otosclerosis.
Yes.
The problem you had. Just, you know, when did that start affecting you? What point in your career?
It started around 1967, and I immediately went in and had surgery, and the surgery was unsuccessful, and there was I had nothing done after that for 10 years. I had visited with several specialists around the country, and it was evident that if nothing could be done, I was going to go deaf. And I lived with it for 10 years, and my hearing got increasingly worse to the point of where I was almost reading lips. And fortunately, 10 years after that, 1977, I had a second operation by a doctor here in L.A., whose name is Victor Goodhill. And we had great success with that operation. So a year later, I had the other ear operated on, and so far, that's not the door. It's me knocking wood. Everything has been great.
How close was it to really, you know?
It was close. Very close.
This is as important as hearing is to every human being, in your case, where it's your whole livelihood and what you probably love the most.
Well, to me, it was my life, you know. I just, I tried not to think about it a lot and kept it a secret for a long time. Didn't talk about it to anybody.
I imagine that made, like, stage performing difficult when, I mean...
Well, I was always afraid that I wouldn't be able to hear enough to sing in tune. And if that happened or began to happen, I probably would have dropped out of the business.
There's really only a couple guys in the world that could have even have done that for you, the operation. At that point.
Well, it's a very fragile operation because the whole thing is done through a funnel in the middle ear with microscopic instruments. In one particular case, Dr. Goodhill had to go to the bone bank in UCLA and make me a Stapes bone, because in the first operation, the Stapes bone had been amputated, and they'd put a little piece of metal in there, which never really worked. And I had a great success with him doing that.
It was actually taking another human bone and forming it.
Well, he had to actually make one. They didn't, you know, they actually cut out a bone. And I don't know if you've ever seen what a Stapes bone looks like, but if it fell on the floor, we probably would have difficulty finding it.
This, getting that, you know, hearing back, is what you were down, like, what, about 85%?
Oh, I was less even, yeah. I had about 20% of my hearing left.
Just once that was restored, it was one at a time, right? One, and then you had the other done later, right?
Well, there was always the danger that even though the operation was successful, it might not last. So he wanted to wait a year to see how it healed and how much of the hearing was actually restored before he did the other ear.
You must have suddenly getting back, I think what you ended up getting up to, what, 90, around 90%?
About 97% in one ear and about 85% in the other ear. So.
Which is probably more than most kids have, you know, they go to rock concerts.
Right.
Let me open this up.
You still going?
Charlie.
Yeah.
Scott Payton.
Hi.
Good to meet you.
Nice meeting you.
Yeah, just to finish, you know. I imagine just little things, you know, around the house must have driven you crazy for a while. You know.
Well, there were a lot of things I wasn't used to hearing. I wasn't used to hearing the sound of traffic or wind or... all of the telephone equipment I had in my home was special equipment for the deaf. So, I mean, I had a volume level on my phone, and I was listening up around 10, which is as high as you could take it.
Afterward, once things were successful and everything, have you devoted any time or energy?
Yes, I have. I've done some hearing commercials, public service commercials. And anybody who writes to me and wants to know anything about hearing, I usually send them to Dr. Goodhill or give them as much information as I can possibly give them. But I think more should be done on that particular subject. It's a social problem that we are having. Lots of people are losing their hearing, and for a number of reasons. It's not just music. In my case, it wasn't music at all.